You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Sell the news, sell the news. The United States Strategic Shitcoin Reserve is here. Bitcoin is down $828 in the last 24 hours. James Check is here to join us. What a time to be alive, sir.
G'day, mate. Yeah, it's a strange time to be alive, but, you know, what do you expect?
Chaos. We should all have expected chaos. Got a meme. A president who won his first election on memes and arguably his second election on memes as well. Getting into meme coins and shitcoinery. Are you shocked?
I mean, wasn't that surprise. I mean, this was always the expected result, right? You wade into the dirty waters of politics, you know, financial incentives. This is what crypto is built on, right? So, you know, it's kind of a match made in heaven. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, you roll with the pigs, you're going to get dirty. You're going to get dirty, freaks.
That's it. Yeah, no, it's funny because, like, I mean, we're talking in the morning where they've just announced the executive order. He's just signed it. It's funny, like, I didn't read the wording word for word, but it's like an announcement of announcement. They're going to think about maybe having a committee where they sit down and talk about what's going to go into the stockpile. And if I understand correctly, it's probably in the stockpile realm where it's hang on to those that they've seized, not actively going and buying more, which is, to be honest, I think was always the expected result. And in my view, probably better. Like, I'm not hugely on board with the go out there and buy the Bitcoin side of the equation. It's obviously hard to reason about, but it just doesn't sit well with me yet. I think Nick Carter did a good job writing up on why that is, but it's, you know, strange dynamics nonetheless.
Yes. Are you saying you agree with Nick in the sense that actively going out to the market, signaling that you prefer Bitcoin, or maybe not even prefer, but would like to have Bitcoin as a strategic reserve asset, would signal externally that treasuries are not worth holding and therefore there would be a dump and that would attack the reserves of the banking system, essentially?
I think so. And look, there's a few layers to it, right? Because markets are a combination, and markets are a process. And there's a process of the market coming to the end state reality. And then there's the perception in the immediate term. And, you know, we all know that we're going through a sovereign debt crisis of, you know, a growing magnitude. And I can't help but think, you know, a lot of people assign a lot of weight to the gold reserves and say, well, they've already got gold. They may as well hold Bitcoin. But my take on this, like, the gold's valued at $42. And that's kind of symbolic that it really is a relic of the past. It's something that has been, you know, the US is not actively trading gold to maintain its reserves. Nick rightly points out that the US dollar is a fully floating currency. They're not backed with anything aside from the full faith and credit of the US. And I can't imagine that them starting to actively buy Bitcoin. And it's funny because I can reason about it from both sides. Me as an individual, why do I stack Bitcoin? Because it makes all the sense in the world. We as a company, why do we stack Bitcoin? Because it makes all the sense in the world. So doesn't that logic apply for countries? And I do think we're going to see countries with surpluses, you know, the Gulf states. I think we're also going to see, you know, Russia and China. It makes sense. They run a massive surplus. It makes sense to put some of that into an uncensorable hard asset. But does the US need to go through with this? I don't know. And there's a few layers. Does it signal to the treasury market that you are, in fact, dog shit? Is it kind of like just taking the veil completely off? How do bond markets act, the bond market, actually deal with that? What does it mean for the US dollar? But then I also look at the other side, which is, you know, they're doing all this stuff via executive order. In order for any of this stuff to really stick, it's got to go through Congress, which is a whole different animal. And, you know, as Bitcoiners, we're low time preference. You don't really want these kind of sticky band-aids. It's basically a political win. You want something that's going to last and be well thought out and well considered. So you really have to go through the full political spectrum. And then if I look at that equation, if you go outside and ask the average American, and again, as an Australian, I'm just speculating here, but I would imagine this is true. Go out and ask the average American, hey, we've got $500 billion. Would you like us to buy Bitcoin with it? And they might be like, bro, I don't have a job. Like, no, please, like fix my life. Or, you know, I've got whatever hardships and pain is going on in my world. couldn't give a rat's ass about this Bitcoin thing. Is that still around? I just think the average person is going to look at those dollars and go, but why are you spending them on me? And in many ways, that's kind of what Trump was elected on. You're spending all this money on not me, time to spend it on me. And I think, you know, Bitcoiners aren't really the me that people really care that much about.
No. I had another podcast I recorded this morning, and that was one of the messages I sent out there. Everybody's been kvetching for the last day and a half. Where's the executive order on the strategic Bitcoin reserve? When's it going to happen? It's like, the dude just got elected on a massive campaign of change domestically, economically. And as you mentioned, if we're being objectively clear-eyed here, the Bitcoin reserve is not in the top three, probably not in the top 10 of priorities of an overwhelming majority of the United States citizens. It's just
absolutely
a plain fact.
I mean, for me, freeing Ross, that was the big thing. That was ultimately the main win. And it was funny, actually, because I didn't expect, I mean, obviously I've been an advocate for Ross for a while, but like to kind of actually feel that, hey, he kept that promise. That was actually quite positive. It was actually a good morning when I saw that news. So I think that's, in many ways, that's really the only thing that I really wanted to happen. Everything else, you know, fix the world. The money's a part of it, but you gotta fix all sorts of other things as well, right? It's not just a single shot. And just putting Bitcoin in the balance sheet, it's not going to fix the money, fix the world. It's going to take a long, long time for that process to happen. So, you know, low time preference. Take it a step back. You know, the slower and steadier this grows, the better.
Yeah, and turn your perceived losses into wins. The price isn't pumping. The U.S. government did not go out there and signal that it's going to market buy Bitcoin every day. The price is down. You get to stack more sats. We're approaching 1,000 sats.
We're crashing to 102K these days. It's pretty wild stuff.
Yeah, but right before we hit record, you said this is one of the harder markets to read that you've observed in recent months.
Yeah, it's a strange one. So I did a slide deck for our subscribers back in December. And part of that thesis was, I think it's going to be a choppy Q1. There's a whole lot of things going on, but, you know, bond yields are trading higher on the long end, which all things being equal should be a drain on liquidity, because if your bond yields are going up, the price is going down. And if the price of the foundation of your financial system is going down, that's going to be a drain on liquidity. Plus, it lifts the benchmark interest rate for everything. So the long end selling off should be a constraint. The dollar's been really strong, which also should be a constraint, because the rest of the world's going to have a harder time paying back their debts, and it's effectively devaluing. I mean, the Australian dollar, if you want to look at a shitcoin chart, go and look at the Australian dollar. It's getting absolutely pummeled. So all of this is a net drain on liquidity, and yet gold and Bitcoin are doing really well. And I mean, rarely do I say go down and look at the Bitcoin price on like the hourly chart, but look at the last like 2 weeks on the hourly chart. It's chaos. It's up, down, left, right. It's all over the place. So that's very political, right? So my thesis was that I think Q1 is going to be very choppy. And the reason is the world's got to adjust to a new presidency. It's very different to the old presidency, and the policies are going to be quite significant. Are tariffs going to happen? Are they not going to happen? How much of these things is he going to follow through? And they're fairly big changes. And, you know, right out the gate, he's made some pretty significant moves. So we're getting a bit of a flavor, but it just feels like the market's going to take time to adjust to this and actually work out which direction it wants to go. So I still expect a really choppy Q1. I'm quite positive for Bitcoin long-term, right? And when I say long-term for 2025, I think this year is going to be a good year. But I do think that people are going to have to get very used to gut checks. I think it's going to be a positive year, but it's not going to be a straight line. I think that's across all markets. I think there's going to be some pretty wild swings, and it just won't be smooth sailing.
Yeah, it feels, I mean, we're day three, so it doesn't feel like it's a pure fact. We're in the honeymoon phase,
yes,
the honeymoon period of this administration. And while everybody, or not everybody, but many people, myself included, are very happy with many of the executive orders that have been signed and the signal that the Trump admin is sending to the market about what it wants to do from an economic perspective, we're in the honeymoon period, and I do think, regardless of the positive economic changes that may be on the horizon, you do have this immovable, undeniable, impossible to ignore sovereign debt crisis bubbling up. And as you mentioned, Dixie's around 110, 10-year yield approaching 5%, $6 trillion of debt that we need to roll over this year. Interest expense on the debt already surpassed defense spending. And so the, whether it's waiting for Trump to sign more executive orders and really set economic policy or a potential liquidity crisis, which I wouldn't be shocked if it materialized at some point in the Q1, Q2 of this year, I completely agree. You have to prepare for gut checks with the Bitcoin price.
Yeah. And I think the, I was talking about this the other day. It's really important to not mistake, like take all the big information, right? We obviously, as Bitcoiners, we're looking long-term. You take all these, you know, we know they're going to have to print the money, but don't apply that knowledge to the next daily candle because these things take macro time. They're glacial in speed. Sometimes they go through periods where they just explode, right? They gradually then suddenly, but don't take all the big information and apply it to the next daily candle because you'll get confused. And likewise, don't take the next daily candle and apply it to the macro thesis. Lots of people are going to get lost by basically looking at the hourly price chart. They'll see a bunch of red candles. They'll say, oh shit, it's all over. And then they'll extrapolate that into a macro trend. Take a zoom out and look at the Bitcoin price. It is just this beautiful stair-stepping pattern to the upside. It's fantastic. This cycle, if you can believe it, we're actually, if you measure it from the cycle low, which I prefer to do, and I was talking to my analysts at Glassnode the other day, and we're like, what's our favorite stupid chart that like we don't put any stock in whatsoever, but we like looking at? And mine's that one where you look at like the index price, you put everything from the cycle low. This current cycle is word for word doing exactly the same thing that 2016 and 17 did. And there's a lot of parallels actually between those two cycles, very spot driven with the ETFs. And back then we didn't really have derivatives. There's a lot of similarities. It's amazing to me that we're following that path. I don't know if we will follow that path on the right-hand side of the chart, but we certainly have on the left-hand side. And if you just kind of frame it up from that perspective, really stable, really healthy. Don't get caught up in the noise because it's a really, really robust uptrend. It, I mean, we've barely had a 25% correction this whole time, right? We went down 32% back in August last year, and it was for 3 hours. You know, like that's the worst it's been. Go back to any previous bull market, you're down 35, down 40, down 50 on a regular basis.
Yeah, what was it? A couple of weeks ago, we dumped to 89,000 or something like that temporarily.
Pulled yeah, right back for up. Like 20 minutes.
Yeah. That is, and that's historically, that's when people make the biggest mistakes is when the market lulls them into this state of complacency or state of, it's weird because it's two-sided. You either get complacent, you're not paying attention, or you're paying too much attention, you make stupid moves, and the market just jumps the other way.
Yeah, and understanding time frames, right? We're in a monthly scale uptrend. You can have weekly scale corrections and consolidations within that, right? That doesn't necessarily disrupt the macro scale. And likewise, you can have a like every monthly uptrend is a sequence of weekly bulls and bears, right? You've got to kind of envision people like, well, what's, is it a bull market? Is it a bear market? It's like, well, what time frame are you on? If you're looking at the hourly chart, there's bull markets and bear markets three times a day. You know what I mean? Like it depends how the market cycle actually plays out, what time frame you're looking at things, and try not to extrapolate the wrong time frame to a different one, because quite often they just, you know, the hourly chart's kind of irrelevant when you look at it in a monthly scale.
What's up, freaks? This is Nat. You don't want to skip because Fold has a great offer for you. Everyone knows about Fold, the app where you can earn the most Bitcoin rewards for everyday purchases. I did this yesterday. Me and my wife, we use Amazon to buy quite a few things. And instead of just putting our credit card into Amazon and buying there, I put my credit card into Fold and buy an Amazon gift card and upload it to Amazon. Why? Because I get the credit card points and then I get sats back. Yesterday, I bought a gift card. I made 10,181 sats, about $10.50 in Bitcoin. And it's the only way to do it. If you want to stack Bitcoin passively, make sure you're using Fold gift cards. Fold has a special deal. I mentioned it earlier. If you're not shopping with Fold gift cards, you're leaving sats on the table. New users that sign up to Fold are going to get 20,000 sats in a welcome bonus with their first gift card purchase. So don't leave sats on the table. Sign up now at foldapp.com/Marty. Get those 20,000 sats, freaks. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20. So what do you think about the honeymoon period? How long does it last? What is the next catalyst you're looking for to move the market one way or the other? Because I saw you tweeted that yesterday. We're sort of at this point where volatility is pretty low and the market could break one way or the other. I forget the exact
indicator.
The choppy index. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is interesting. So when you come to the end of the year, because we had a soft December, and this is because Bitcoin did really well last year. I forget the numbers, like 120% or whatever it is. And a lot of these, like now that we're institutional in scale, a lot of these funds, they've got a balance sheet, they've got a P&L statement. They don't really want to give back 10, 20% at the end of the year. They want to have a nice green number that they can give to their investors and say, this is why you put your money with us. Look how well we did. So we saw a lot of closing out of positions. We actually saw a lot of the cash and carry trade coming out of the market. Open interest declined on CME. So December very much was like a clearing of the books, lock it all in. Here's our fresh balance sheet. And then they go into the next year. And in January, obviously, we've got a new president coming on the 20th or the 21st. There's this process of we want to reallocate money. We've cleared the books in December. Now we want to reallocate at the start of the year. But we've also got this like big variable that's coming that we're currently in that process of seeing what shape it looks like. Now, at the start of years, all these desks, not only do they reallocate capital and rebalance portfolios and all that stuff, they re-lever. So because they've got a fresh income statement, they can essentially re-lever up their assets, work out what they do and don't want to hold. And, you know, Bitcoin's going to be a part of that mix. Again, it's amazing that we haven't had deeper corrections. So I think there is a genuine spot demand for this thing. But after that's happened, everyone's allocated, everyone's re-levered. What next? And this happens all the time, right? So February and March is generally actually a softer period in all markets because everyone's kind of put that capital flow in. And then they're all like, all right, so now what happens? And, you know, the market's got to find some new catalyst. Now, I don't know. This is what I think makes the environment so difficult is that it's a political one. Do they go ahead with tax cuts? Because tax cuts are going to be positive for, you know, generally speaking, for business. Do they go ahead with tariffs? That's probably not going to be so good for risk assets. So really, because we're in this political arena, we just don't know. And it really depends on the shape of these things. And one thing you can say about Trump is that he seems to be sticking to his guns. He said certain things that he's going to do. And as far as it looks, he seems to be doing them. So he's been talking about tariffs. He's been talking about tax cuts. I would probably factor in that we've got tax cuts and tariffs coming. And that's going to impact markets in both directions.
Yeah, I was listening to Luke Roman. He was on a podcast yesterday talking about tariffs specifically, and he was actually warning. It was weird because it was one side it was a warning, the other side it was like inevitably or ultimately this will be good for the U.S. But if you do the tariffs, you can see that pushing Dixie even higher, 10-year even higher, and creating that liquidity crunch in the banking system. And so there is a needle to thread. And I think that's the consensus among many who've been paying close attention to his administration picks, particularly. It's like, if you need somebody to thread a needle, I think he placed the Treasury Secretary very well with Scott Bessent, who's managed a lot of currency trades throughout his career.
Yeah. And I think that's really, a lot of people are like, oh, look, he's a crypto basis and a crypto focus. It's like, guys, he's there to protect the bond market and just sort out the dollar and the treasuries. That's it. That's the job. Sort out the dollar and the treasuries, because that is a much bigger issue than anything else, right? So, and that's why back to Nick's point, I don't think that the gold plays a overly relevant role. Now, what will be very interesting, and I know Groman's talked about this as well, is if they revalue the gold from $42 to spot price, because that would be a very interesting, it would almost break that previous thesis that Nick was talking about and I was talking about, where if they revalue the gold in a way that's bringing it back into the financial system. If that happens, now the Bitcoin reserve idea has a lot more weight to it because they're now saying, hey, we actually do have these assets on the balance sheet. And if you imagine that you had a Bitcoin stockpile slash Bitcoin reserve, maybe that's something that once it's gone through Congress could also be marked to market and that deposits funds into the TGA, right? There's all these different dynamics. What do you do with that money once it gets deposited? That's then a political game. Then you could argue there's a case for, well, we actually want the price of gold and Bitcoin to rise because that's going to deposit more money into the government's treasury account, right? And then you can start to get those dynamics. It's not there yet, but that's definitely something to pay attention to because they need to weaken the dollar. The cure for a high dollar is a high dollar, right? Once you get the dollar high, the rest of the world just can't deal with it, right? I mean, again, the Australian dollar is just getting absolutely crushed. Fortunately, right, we price in US dollars, but at some point in time, I know that's going to flip. I know it's going to flip where the US dollar is going to have to be weakened because the whole world gets wrecked, right? They can't pay their debts. They have to sell dollar assets. And when they've got to sell dollar assets, that just depresses everything. So there's this interesting dynamic where a strong dollar is technically good for inflation internally in the US because you can obviously buy more stuff. You don't import inflation. But at the same time, a strong dollar makes the US less competitive. And if Trump's, and he has really run on reinvigorating American industry, a weaker dollar is really an important part of that factor. And if you don't weaken it, the rest of the world's going to catch a cold and then eventually the US will get the sniffles.
This rip was brought to you by our great friends at Unchained. As Bitcoin's role in the global financial landscape evolves, understanding its potential impact on your wealth becomes increasingly crucial. Whether we see measured adoption or accelerated hyper-Bitcoinization, being prepared for various scenarios can make the difference between merely participating and truly optimizing your position. This is important, freaks. This is why Unchained developed the Bitcoin Calculator, a sophisticated modeling tool that helps you visualize and prepare for multiple Bitcoin futures. Beyond traditional retirement planning, it offers deep insights into how different adoption scenarios could transform your wealth trajectory. What sets this tool apart is the integration with the Unchained IRA, the only solution that combines with tax advantages of a retirement account with the security of self-custody. In any future state, maintaining direct control of your keys remains fundamental to your Bitcoin strategy. Go explore the potential futures at unchained.com/TFTC. Bitcoin is going up. Make sure you're protecting it the right way. Make sure you have a good partner. That is Unchained. Go to unchained.com/TFTC.
Yeah. And the other thing since we last recorded in October, you've had this dynamic with the Fed cutting rates, and the 10-year and 30-year not playing ball, inversely correlated almost perfectly with the rate cuts that the Fed has been making, which there's another variable that probably, I have to imagine it was unexpected. I have to imagine that caught Jerome Powell off guard, or maybe he knew they didn't really tame inflation, and so the markets are going to call bullshit, but that's another weird dynamic at play.
It is. And if, you know, again, I haven't been around in markets long enough to have the firsthand experience, but as far as I'm aware, this doesn't happen often where you have the Fed cutting rates. Usually the whole treasury curve should come down in rates, but we're actually seeing the bond market just go nut. So this is like bond vigilante type material where they're like, no, we're calling bullshit. Whether it's inflation, whether it's just the knowledge that at the moment, the US has been basically issuing short-term debt. Yellen kind of pulled this trick where if you issue all this short-term debt, you can get money out of the reverse repo facility. So post-COVID, there's what, $2.5 trillion or something in there. By issuing short-term treasury bills, you could essentially extract that money back out into the economy. Now, that's more or less drained. The reverse repo is more or less, you know, been depleted. And if you think about what short-term treasuries are, I mean, it's kind of payday lending in a way for governments. You can't do that forever, right? Because the interest rates are going to be higher and eventually they've got to term this stuff out. So therefore, I think the market is now recognizing, and I believe Scott Bessent also said this, they have to start getting more issuance on the long end. So not only are the bond vigilantes saying, well, we're not sure that you've tamed inflation. There's probably a whole lot of reasons why they expect inflation to start coming back. But then they're also saying there's also a lot of issuance coming. So because there's a lot of issuance, it's like, well, that's sell pressure. I may as well get out before and buy these things later. And when they sell bonds, the yield goes up. And it's also interesting that gold, I mean, as Bitcoin as well, but I think gold, I think is a really important price chart to pay attention to. Generally speaking, in terms of like what I look at day to day, Bitcoin, because I think Bitcoin's like a global index 24/7, gold is my baseline. When I'm talking about like inflation expectations, sovereign debt crisis, I think gold is a really important price. And I think Bitcoin should keep an eye on it because it's telling you the story. Rates going up. Why would you hold a 0% yielding? We know why you buy Bitcoin, because it's got this adoption and growth pathway ahead of it. For gold, it's reached that maturity. Why would you buy a zero yielding forever bond when you could buy a treasury for 4.5%? It's because you think the treasuries are going to get worse, right? So at the end of the day, gold is a bit of an index on, I use it as my denominator for a lot of things. It's kind of my benchmark. Is an asset beating gold? If not, it's probably not going to beat the inflationary environment that we're in. That's how I like to frame these things up. So I think the Bitcoin, obviously, gold, the DXY, I think just understanding where the dollar is at, oil, because oil is obviously the input, and then bonds, right? That's really my like core framework because they're the most important prices. And just getting a bit of a gauge on how those things are trading relative to each other is really important. And you're right. You know, they've got this big divergence between gold performance and treasuries. You've got this big divergence in terms of like, why is the dollar going up? Usually that's bad for metal. Usually that's bad for Bitcoin. But the dollar is extremely high and sound money keeps going up. So what signal is that telling us?
Yeah. Yeah, I have to imagine market participants are forward looking to this $6 trillion that needs to be rolled over, like you said, and just dumping, waiting for it to happen. But going back to the interest expense on the debt, outpacing defense and military spending. Like, imagine if they can't control the yield curve and bring it down a bit lower, and Scott Bessent is explicitly saying we need to issue out on the longer end, and you're turning over $6 trillion worth of long-end bonds, that slope on the interest expense on the debt is going to go way higher.
And that's the thing, right? So if the bond market has a spasm, right, has some kind of, you know, last time we got to 5% in 23, things started to get pretty hairy. If you get to those levels, and we saw this in the UK with the gilt crisis, and their bonds are trading worse than they were during that gilt crisis, granted, it's been a gradual slope higher, it puts immense amounts of stress on the system. And it's one of those things where the bond market calls time. You know, as Grohmann would say, long term, this is great for Bitcoin and great for gold, because they're going to have to print the money to control this thing, because financial stability is super important. But it's really important to remember that there's going to be these gut checks. The bond market is likely to call time on all of this stuff at some point. And there's that initial shockwave. Something happens. Yes, we eventually are going to have to print money to solve this problem, but it usually doesn't come just off the back of, you know, oh, we may as well just start now. It's like, no, it comes off the back of some kind of an event. I did listen to Lynn the other day, which I thought was an interesting perspective. And I think it makes sense to me, which is that it's probably going to be a slower, more gradual process rather than like a shockwave. That's like another framework, rather than like a March 2020 or some kind of bond crisis. It's this like gradual process of like persistently printing money, whether they go back to QE or they give it some other name, right? Some alphabet soup program that kind of keeps things stable. But I think that these are two different scenarios. And I really do think thinking in scenarios is super important. And that's why whenever I write my newsletter, the whole idea of it, I'm not going to predict the future. I got no idea. None of us do. And it's a fool's errand to try. But I want to know exactly what does the downside risk look like, and what am I going to do? If I wake up tomorrow and Bitcoin's got an 8 handle, right, it's in the 80,000s, I've already made my decision of what I'm going to do. If Bitcoin is up at 120 or 150K, I've also already made my decision for what I'm going to do. Even if I don't need one of those tools, I've thought about it in advance, because the only thing you can control is your decisions. You can't control the market. You can't control what politicians do. All you can just choose is, what are you going to do if that scenario plays out?
Yeah. And are those the two scenarios you're preparing for right now, an 8 handle or?
Yeah. Well, look, so I'll go through both of those, right? Let's talk about the upside first, because most people are excited about that. When I look at, you know, people ask me, when's the top? It's like, I don't know. Which top? If you're a day trader, the top is the one that just liquidated you, right? The top is the one that matters to you. If you're a retiree, the top is the one that gives you 3 years of runway so you can live your life happily. If you're a sat stacker like me, then, you know, the top is probably much, much, much higher, right? The one that you care about, or the one that starts like a 4-year bear market. I also think about, you know, could we have an 80% correction from here? That's 20 grand, right? I just don't see this as being the case. We've proven that we're a $1 trillion asset now. You know, we tried it twice in 2021. We finally broke through in and held it for 7 months back in mid last year. And then we just teleported to 2 trillion, right? We flipped silver. Silver didn't even try and fight back. And we've just been chopping around up here, which I think is really, really stable. But if we get to 120 and then 150, they're the two levels that I've got in my mind at the moment. 120 is when we hit the bottom of what I've got this model I call like a topping cloud. It's basically when the average Bitcoiner is pretty up on their position, right? Modestly profitable, pretty happy. We usually start to see quite a bit of sell side at that point. If we get to 150, every single metric that I look at is going to be lit up like a Christmas tree, right? 4% of all trading days have been higher than that level. Now, that doesn't mean we can't keep going because 4% is not zero, but there's a 4% chance, right? So if you think about things in terms of probabilities, I think we clear 120. I don't think we go above 150 without some kind of process. I think there's going to be a process in there. Now, to the downside, when we teleported in November, we basically went from 73 straight to 100, right? Well, 99.8, because it took us a couple of weeks to get to 100. But we basically just ripped through the 80,000s. And I talk about, like, I call it an air pocket. When we look at where all the supply changed hands and transacted, very little supply transacted between 73K and 86. That zone is a bit of a gap. We don't actually know how much demand is down there. Now, for whatever reason, markets like to test these things. So if you've ever done TA, you've probably seen the volume profile, where you can kind of see where all the different, where the trade volume has happened at different price levels. There's basically nothing between 73 and 86. So that becomes a bit of a magnet. The market may want to find out how much demand have you got. So if we get some kind of downside, that's a zone of interest. Short-term holder cost basis is about 90K at the moment. That's the tipping point. That 90,000 level, that short-term cost base, it's a zone. It's not a perfect price. But the idea is that once you get down to that level, all the guys who bought recently are suddenly either at their cost basis or underwater, starting to feel a little bit of stress. The further you go below that, the more they start to look at their portfolio and go, oh man, I bought all those coins at 106 and 108. Now I'm feeling pretty shitty about it. They're the kind of people who start to capitulate out, and you can kind of generate this cascade. So that's an area of interest. It's kind of interesting that we've got this support level, which should hold at around 90K, but below it, there's just not much.
Yeah. So you said 73 to 86, that level?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? Could I imagine, and again, thinking in scenarios, could I imagine that we rip to 150 and then we bear market back down to 73? I can absolutely construct a story for how that could play out, right? And suddenly we're not talking about an 80% correction, but we're talking about a pretty decent pullback, about a 50% or thereabouts. I can see that happening. I'm not saying that will happen, but I can definitely see that as a potential scenario if, let's say, these tariffs go really pear-shaped and suddenly we get a bit of a breakdown of, you know, how these countries are communicating with each other. I don't think that's my base case. What's my base case? We probably get above 120. I don't think we clear 150. My base case is that we actually lose sight of what a bear market is. Let's say we go to 150 and we pull back to 90 or 80. What is that? Is that a bear market? What if it takes 9 months or 12 months to resolve? Are we still in a super cycle if we then go to 300? Is that all part of one cycle, or that we just have a bear, right? And I think people are going to start losing track of what is a cycle, because if there's ever a time for it to break, it's probably now.
Just a cycle theory in general?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I say that full well knowing that we're following the last two cycles like to the dot. So, you know, I say that I don't know what the right-hand side looks like, and none of us do. What I do think is that our previous models, one of the concepts that I play with, a lot of people have heard of the realized price. It's the average cost basis for all Bitcoin. Now, there's actually a real problem with the realized price, and that is that if Satoshi, and back in when FTX blew up, when we're at break even, right? So in theory, the average investor is at their break even level. Satoshi's got $38 billion of unrealized profit that he probably can't take. So that means there's $38 billion of losses that some guy who's active today is holding and is probably feeling really bad about his decisions. So that realized price level, which has historically been the floor, it's about 46K, I think, at the moment. That's actually, I think that model stops working. And therefore, I think MVRV stops working, which is one of the most popular on-chain metrics. I think we have to start rethinking some of these different models, because in a way, you need the damage to be so bad. And I actually didn't think we would get down there last cycle, but it required Luna plus three arrows, plus the GBTC unwind, plus FTX. That's the kind of damage that it took to get us down to that level. Unless we get something similar, I'm struggling to see that we're going to get down that far. So I've got some other models which tries to remove Satoshi and all the early miners, and it basically time weights coins. It looks at where is the average active investor, gets rid of all the lost stuff, and just looks at active investors. And that price is currently, from memory, it's about 70K. So we're kind of right in the middle of our chop solidation range. Maybe it's like 65. It's in that chop solidation range. I could imagine us pulling back and having some kind of a bear market that tests that chop solidation range. And everyone goes, oh, it's going to the realized price. What if it doesn't? What if we actually have this kind of phase shift where the market doesn't have as big upside, doesn't have as big downside, still takes about the same amount of time, but people lose sense of the amplitude? So these are some of the interesting ideas I'm playing around with. Just try and, you know, have these plans and ideas before they happen.
That's fascinating too, because as you're describing that and explaining this new metric, that's always been something I've thought about, like how much do the metrics drive, like do people look at MVRV and look at that potential low 46,000 and just psychologically say, like, all right, that's the limit. And what is the production of a new indicator with like a higher that takes out all the Satoshi coins and lost coins take that into consideration, then that drifts it higher. Like, is the market reacting to the indicator? Or get what
or
I'm
is
trying
the indicator
to get
describing the psychological cost base? I think it's the latter. I think the indicators, and that's what I like about on-chain data. First things first, having been in this industry for a long time, nobody knows what's going on. There are so few people who spent any amount of time to do the proof of work to understand this stuff. So no, I don't think that people are looking at the realized price and saying, oh, well, that's my level. But I think human beings respond to their cost basis. They make their own individual decisions based on where their levels are. And we also, that's why we look at things like long-term holder, short-term holder, because they do have very different behavior patterns. And this, every time I raise this, right, long-term holders, people are like, oh, but 6 months is not a long-term holder. You've got to be here for four cycles. It's like, it doesn't matter what you think the long-term holder is. At that tipping point of about 6 months, the probability of every UTXO in any year, there's been many people who've studied this, the change in behavior is very similar. So people after 6 months all have a very similar probability of spending their coins. Before 6 months, they have a massive, like it's a massive decay. Most of the coins moving around were moved yesterday. The next largest amount of coins were moved in the last week. The next largest were moved in the last month. And this is like an exponential decay. So when we look at short-term holders, the reason why we look at this balance between long and short-term holders is when you've got a market that's saturated with new buyers, they're people who are buying their first Bitcoin or they have an experience of volatility, you've got these new buyers with a very high cost basis. They are highly sensitive to vol. Long-term holders, they don't care. They sell, they wait, and they sell on the way up. So that's why we look at all these different dynamics to say, well, where's their cost basis? Where's that inflection point when people go from having a really fun time to having a really shit time? And that's a, I think that's an interesting dynamic. The one thing I think will cloud some of this is actually the likes of MicroStrategy and potentially this whole meme coin phenomena. I'm seeing more and more, and I don't know about you, but I'm amazed at how quickly the Bitcoin, not crypto, is happening. That has been a really big shift to the point where I'm seeing a lot of analysts who've been bearish on Bitcoin forever saying, oh, Bitcoin's okay, but MicroStrategy is the scam, right? So they're now kind of flipping around where Bitcoin is, it's crossed that Rubicon now for many people. And I can't help but imagine a lot of the leverage and the sensitive buyers probably going to end up in the likes of MicroStrategy, where people are going to find out that call options mostly expire worthless, and it's going to just, like, that's a zero, right? If you buy these call options, if MSTR doesn't rip and it doesn't rip and you don't sell those options, they're going to go to zero. So I think a lot of people are going to learn that lesson. And I also think in these meme coins, I mean, we know they're going to go to zero, but like, where's the speculative fever in Bitcoin itself? We haven't even seen in futures markets it get overly like crazy in terms of funding rates. Like, it's been very, very tame. So I can't help but feel that a lot of the speculative momentum has moved elsewhere, which is actually kind of favoring Bitcoin having a much more stable, steady climb, which in many ways it has.
Yeah, just isolate all the degeneracy to
pretty much
the options world, the paper world. outside of Bitcoin, right? To these equities and mentioning MicroStrategy to that's one thing I've been wondering as we head into or continue in we're in the cycle already, but as we move forward through time, you mentioned Satoshi's coins, all those older actors that likely aren't going to move in. I think MicroStrategy is a new class of that type of hodler. At least that's what they're signaling publicly in the way they're terming out their convertible notes. The durations are such that they're likely going to catch the upside of a 4-year cycle if they continue. But if it's just a persistent, constant bid up and we just go up into the right in a steady fashion, that's beneficial for them as well. And then I'm sure you've seen it, but I think this trend of Bitcoin collateralized debt making a strong comeback, but not only that, but with more legitimate players. If you read Ross Stevens's annual letter from Stone Ridge.
It was really terrific, by the way. If you haven't read it, a terrific letter.
Yeah, really leaned into it seems like NYDIG is going to get into Bitcoin-backed collateral or Bitcoin-backed lending in a big way. You have products like Battery Finance that are coming to market, and they're dual collateralizing traditional assets with Bitcoin on a longer duration. So you're thinking 10, 12, 15 years, maybe. We might have discussed this last time you were on, but I don't believe we did. But I think that's another interesting factor. Who knows how much of an overall impact we'll have this cycle, but I think over time, as these types of demand drivers come to market and take supply off for a longer period of time, that's got to change the dynamic of the historical volatility as well. Not the historical volatility, the volatility moving forward as well.
Yes, no, I fully agree. And actually, I was answering this question the other day. Someone was like, what happens with all on-chain data? I get this all the time. What happens with all these metrics when people start, you know, putting collateral in and just borrowing and doing stuff in their life? It's like, well, technically, isn't that the perfect example of long-term holder supply? If it remains dormant in some multi-sig where people can now borrow money with some reputable institution, they can live their life, they can buy their house. They have made a conscious decision to not sell the corn, right? They're hanging on to the Bitcoin. So in a way, that is almost by definition what you want to see in terms of how many coins are locked up there. What you got to balance that by is there could be a buildup of leverage. Let's say a bunch of people are borrowing against their Bitcoin and suddenly the price goes into a bear and they start getting tested. You have to have that extra data point of saying how sensitive are people to actually selling those coins as a result or having to clear some of that collateral. So it's one of those things where it makes perfect sense in an on-chain world. You just have to add that extra data point of understanding what does the leverage profile look like? How do we frame that up? How do we think about all these different sectors of the Bitcoin economy?
Yeah. Yeah. And how many Bitcoiners with a large amount, which I imagine would be a lot, are actually privy to the concept of buy, borrow, die, and would be able and willing to put that into practice? Yeah, don't put your whole stack in there, freaks. Price goes down, you need to add collateral. You're going to want some Bitcoin to do that. You're going to lose
and that's the thing, right? Like leverage is, it cuts both ways. You got to be so careful with it because it can, you know, what you think can't happen can absolutely happen. You can certainly frame up probabilities for these things, but you know, I've had very improbable events that I'd put levered bets on. Most of the time they actually came true. And it's usually because my perception of what could happen was clouded by my desire to take on leverage and do whatever it was, buy more Bitcoin or whatever that trade was. My perception of risk changes because you like the result when it's going up. You may not like the result when it's coming down. And just like if you can't sleep at night, you've got too much of a position on in some way. So just be really careful with leverage because we are in a political environment. Things are going to chop around and change. Even though I think we have net tailwinds, I do think that there's going to be a choppy road. And this is for all markets. I think, you know, if equities pull back, I think Bitcoin probably pulls back as well, right? All these things tend to be correlated during these periods. So just be really, really careful.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, I wanted to touch on this with you because you called the shot years ago before Ethereum embarked on the merge, Ethereum 2.0. That's another interesting story in the industry right now. Ethereum is looking a bit anemic right now. A lot of chaos over in the Ethereum quote-unquote community. It's like Vitalik Buterin has his wartime CEO hat on, has explicitly signaling to the market that he's in charge and he's going to figure things out. And meanwhile, the ETH to BTC ratio is below where it was when it officially got added to Coinbase many years ago.
And what a painful stat.
If you freaks haven't seen it, many of you who are new probably haven't, but you made an incredible YouTube video years ago at this point, two or three, whatever.
It was a month before the merge.
So that was
2020, August 2022 or something.
2022, yeah. Almost 2.5 years ago. And you called it. This was the biggest mistake ever for them, going from proof of work to proof of stake, hard forking, changing the foundation of the system that they were expecting people to build on, and the asset that flows through that system has suffered immensely.
It has. Look, this is the thing, right? I used to use Ethereum way back in the day, like pre-2020. So I've tested all the DeFi stuff. I'm an engineer. I like to tinker with things and find out how things work. And like everybody, you come in, you don't fully understand Bitcoin. Eventually you recognize it and it all clicks. I find the Ethereum thing, I find like the crypto world in general, I'm a fascinated observer because we have watched them rebuild Wall Street bug for bug, time and time again. I've heard people calling this the golden age of grift, right? With all these meme coins and like, it is a fascinating experiment to see how human beings and social creatures that we are, they talk about communities and it's all about community. It is. That's really all it is. It's a shared belief that this shitcoin is going to go up. But for years and years, the shitcoin cycles have always been driven by a new distribution mechanism. It was the ICOs back in 2017, crowdfunding, crowdsourcing. Then we had DeFi yield farming. And then we have the meme coin cycle at the moment. There's all the NFTs, right? Mints and all that stuff. All these are different distribution mechanisms. And that's really what's powered and fired off the last cycle, right? Whatever the shitcoin cycle is. This cycle's been very interesting. And if I just kind of frame up why I think, and Murad's done a good job, I think, of framing this up, but this is my take on it. If you go and look at the 2017 cycle, there weren't really no stablecoins. I think Tether existed, but not at any size. BTC was the pair. You bought Bitcoin, you sent it to Binance or Coinbase or whatever, and you traded shitcoin. So BTC was the thing you had to buy. It was the casino chip to go and bet on other stuff. Now, Bitcoin being special has left that realm where it actually doesn't need that demand anymore. It doesn't need to be the quote pair for the casino to achieve its value proposition. In the 2021-22 cycle, that was Ethereum. You had to buy ETH, the casino chip, to go and play in the DeFi yield farm. You get your 55,000% APY, which rugged you the next day. You needed to buy the casino chip and hold it to do stuff. Whenever an opportunity came up, you can't send your money to Binance, buy the ETH, send it to your wallet, and then go and do the thing because the thing's already pumped. You needed to have the ETH in your wallet. Now, we're seeing that with Solana. And in this whole process, Ethereans got very cocky. They thought we're going to flip Bitcoin. They went after the ultrasound money meme. They did the merge. Now, I know the merge was something that they'd planned since the beginning, but I was looking at this state of play and I said, and I made this video, I think it was called The Merge is a Monumental Blunder. And the reason why I said there's many reasons, right? My big picture take is Ethereum is actually too decentralized. And that's going to be contrary to what a lot of Bitcoiners say, but I think it's too decentralized because they have, credit to them, gone to a whole lot of angle. It's still more centralized than Bitcoin, but they've done a lot of work to be more decentralized than the Trons and the Solanas and all this stuff. However, what if the main thing that your protocol does is move stablecoins around, which could be frozen? Really, the weakest link in your chain is Tether and Circle. That's kind of it. So they've gone down this path of like building all these like decentralized cannons and they've forgotten that they're securing something which can be stolen by the issuer. So at the end of the day, if they freeze stablecoins, the whole thing falls apart. DeFi goes to zero because that's what people borrow. So they've kind of over-designed the machine. And they also went after the ultrasound money meme, which there was a war they were never going to win. And then once they flipped to proof of stake, that was really the last thing they had that was an edge. And if you go back, I've checked, the Ethereum.org website has been since updated, but the two listed reasons for the merge, and this video was made a month before the merge, the two listed reasons were to enable sharding, which is scaling. That got scrapped very soon after the merge, and they already had layer twos and roll-ups and all that stuff going. So technically speaking, you kind of had already made the roll-up centric roadmap decision. So you didn't really need sharding in the first place. And the second one was to be environmentally friendly. And it's like, guys, proof of work is the most environmentally friendly consensus mechanism. It's the only thing you have that is different to Solana, that is different to Tron. They're all proof of stake. And by the way, just if they stayed proof of work, I don't actually think the result would have been any different. But it was the only competitive advantages they had, the only differentiator. Once you go proof of stake, you've just got technical debt. You don't actually have any advantage. You're not faster. You're not slower. Oh, we're more decentralized, but your stablecoins aren't. So that's kind of a moot point. It doesn't really matter that you're more decentralized because I can move stablecoins around on Solana too with the exact same risk profile, right? It's the same shit. So they've really just made a lot of decisions along the way. And I think they're coming to a head as we speak. Obviously, the decline in the ETH BTC price, it's a brutal ride for them, the poor buggers. I do feel for them because even as a Bitcoiner, right, I still think it's all going to zero, but I don't particularly want to see a $400 billion asset go to zero. I don't think that's a net positive. It's better if it happens slowly because people can slowly exit, but you know, you don't want to see value destroyed in the world. But even if you go to the ETH Maxi websites, the PE ratio, at least to their calculation, if you look, and you know, and this is the thing, institutional investors, they come in, be careful what you wish for, one of my friends told me the other day, because when you actually value the tokens or ETH or anything on any typical valuation mechanism, you're not going to like the result because it's like the PE ratio is 780 or 700, 675 or something like that. If you take it down to a more sensible PE of 20 or 21, it's $100 ETH price. That's and like 20 is like on the upper bound of equity. So be careful what you wish for because there's a large monetary premium, so to speak, gap between the current valuation and where it probably wants to go. Now, this is all going to happen to Solana as well, but I think the Trump meme coin is, I'm still kind of processing what happened there and what the implications are. But my big picture take is if you had done, wind back the clock 12 months, 24 months, there's no question that if Trump was going to launch a meme coin, I think everyone would agree it would have been on Ethereum. There's no question. It happened on Solana, right? So the Ethereums have now recognized, and by the way, the amount of trade volume, I think credit to Solana, by the way, the amount of trade volume and load that thing took on that day is unbelievable. From just a technological standpoint, you got to give it credit. That was quite impressive. There's no chance any Ethereum, L2, none of it. None of that system could handle what happened on that Trump meme coin. So I think the Ethereans are now, they've hit this brick wall of recognition that they haven't moved forward. They didn't win on the money front. In the time they spent trying to win the money front, they forgot to win on the thing they're supercomputering at, right? Trying to be the world computer. And Solana's come up behind them and it handled something that at the end of the day, if it's all about a casino, then it's a better casino. So now people are buying the Sol to trade in that casino. And why do you hold the ETH? You know, and I think they're really coming to, and there's no value capture either. What's the value capture mechanism from usage of L2s? They're supposed to pay a tax to the ETH main chain. Again, PE ratio, 675. I would not recommend getting institutional investors to value on your cash flows because it's about $100 ETH price. So it's just, it's a tough scenario for them.
Yeah. And then isn't the largest ETH L2 Coinbase's base? And aren't they not contributing back?
It's basically like saying that, you know, by saying that Base is scaling Ethereum is like saying that Binance is scaling Bitcoin. They're both exactly the same. That's the same thing. You know, and here's the other one that's going to kill them. There's no question, right? I'll put money on this, that Base will swap their gas fees for USDC. So the claim is that you've got to move ETH over there and use it as gas. Again, be careful what you wish for. If you move your ETH over there, what happens if they swap to USD? Because at the end of the day, Base may very well want to bring on institutional actors. And you know what? Institutions are going to fall for this thing and buy real world assets and tokenized stocks and all that shit. That's all going to happen, right? I'm very confident that will happen. Coinbase is positioning Base for the place to do that. They're going to trust that because it's a regulated company, which means they're also not going to take the wheels off. And If Ethereum is literally just a chain that you just like post some hash data to every so often, that's a painful experience. And these institutions, they don't want to hold ETH inventory. They just want dollars. So they'd rather pay their gas fee and be like, oh, it's going to cost me $2 to do this. Great. Cool. It's like a brokerage fee. Problem solved. There's just so few reasons why. Here's my final take on this. Ethereum, the EVM, the blockchain, the L2s, the networks, I think they can, and I would argue, have been very successful. Ethereum has been very successful. There's no reason why ETH has to win. The asset has to benefit from Ethereum winning. And this is where I think a lot of Ethereans get this wrong. Same for Solana. Sol doesn't have to do well for Solana, the blockchain, to work very well. For Bitcoin, that's different because all of these chains, the network is the more important thing and the asset's kind of something that enables the network. Bitcoin's the complete opposite, where BTC is the important thing. The blockchain is just there to support the asset. It's complete polarity shift where it's all about the asset. It's not about the network. It's not about the DeFi. It's not about the tokens. It's not about the stablecoins. It's about Bitcoin. Bitcoin, the chain, supports BTC. ETH supports Ethereum. And I think that's it's a really, really big difference. And it's ultimately playing out in the price.
Yeah, and you mentioned it'll play out similarly for Solana. How do you see that happening?
It's the same thing. Yeah, it's the exact same mechanic. I mean, like at the end of the day, if you want to value this thing based on cash flows, I haven't checked Solana's PE, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to be high, right? If you've got this highly scaling blockchain, it's like in many ways, it's more like the TCP/IP ID. It's, you know, I don't pay for TCP/IP. It just does its thing, right? In many ways, I think by building these networks, they've kind of built that protocol, so to speak, where it transfers value around. But what's the value? It's the $1 billion of stable coins I'm moving around and I'm paying a $3 fee to make it happen. Because if I start paying a $1,000 fee, I'm going to move to a chain where I don't need that. And that's ultimately how it happens, right? The cure for high prices is high prices. Ethereum gas price goes up because people are using it. You better believe all those L2s are going to look and go, well, I can just plug into this chain, which cost me 15 cents. That makes a hell of a lot of an idea. So I can't see a sustainable revenue source here. And John Pfeffer wrote about this way back in 2017. Yeah, this paper is like utility tokens will always trend towards their utility value, which is not much. It's the same reason that gold bugs, when they're like, oh, but gold has industrial use cases. It's like, okay, price it based on dental fillings and tell me what the market cap should be. Because I'll tell you what, it's a hell of a lot lower than 18 trillion.
Yeah. Maybe Tron's had it right this whole time. Justin Sun just literally like, yeah, we're going to keep it centralized. We're going to keep it
cheap. Ironically enough, I think so, right? I mean, Tron is the number one place for Tether. Tether is, it's in emerging markets, they're adopting Tether on Tron. That is a use case. That is a genuine use case for emerging markets, right? It's hard to get dollars for them. They can get it on digital rail and they can move it anywhere. Fantastic. And move it around for cents on the dollar. I mean, at the end of the day, what a good product market fit.
Yeah. It's so fun. And it is, I don't know if I've have as much, I do have some grace, but not as much grace as you towards the Ethereans, because I think they went on this years-long, decade-long propaganda campaign against Bitcoin and mismarketed both networks to the public. And I think they, many people, not everybody, but many, particularly the early Ethereans, hoodwinked a lot of people and completely, maybe they misunderstood, or it's probably a combination of misunderstanding and misconstruing reality. I thought it was going to be more of an epic blow up, something that was structural to some technical change they made during the merge or something like that. But it's just
a slow fade into irrelevance is far worse.
Yeah.
Just this great. And that's the thing, like, it's amazing. I didn't actually expect to see it happen the way it is, and look, this is the thing. You've got all these .ETHs just proclaiming, I'm done, I'm out, I'm finished, I'm selling everything. This is ironically enough what bottoms look like, but I saw this great tweet, which I thought it perfectly summarizes this thing. This is what bottoms look like, if there is one. And I thought that was just such a great way to encapsulate, because if there is one, it's such a painful thing, because it may not have a bottom. It may just keep deteriorating, because someone's got to make me a case as to why Ethereum's going to beat Bitcoin, which, good luck with that, and why Solana's not going to eat its lunch. And on this concept, one of the top signals, I'm always looking for like these anecdotal, I'm trying to formulate what a top might look like at some point, a cyclical top. I also have a suspicion that the tops may be different for Bitcoin versus crypto. I think this divergence is very real. And the one piece of evidence for that, when we hit the all-time high the other day, we got to 109K, Bitcoin's, that 10% daily candle was 40% of Ethereum's market cap, right? In one candle,
holy crap,
Bitcoin did 40% of Ethereum's market cap. It's irrelevant in scale, right? It's just, it's a footnote. So we've already got this divergence. But let's imagine this cycle plays out and we get this whole crypto casino and blah, blah, blah. Whether Ethereum declines and others rally, or Ethereum just doesn't rally as much as the others, whatever it looks like, just imagine the speculative fever that will be happening when there's a possibility that Ethereum is going to get flipped, when the nearest rival is within plus or minus 10, 20% of it. Just imagine the speculation that's going to be going wild on, no, it's going to be Ripple, no, it's going to be Solana, it's going to be this. That is going to be, I think, one of the topping signals. If we get this kind of cycle, I think that's what it's going to look like. Maybe it's Trump coin. Who knows? Maybe it's Dogecoin. Something trying to flip. Everyone's going to be bidding on their coin to try and get it to be number two first. Maybe there's this kind of like rolling interchange. But we've all, Bitcoin has often talked about, if you flip Bitcoin, the industry goes to zero because suddenly there's no faith or trust in any of it. And I actually do agree with that, because I just think Bitcoin, it has such a divergence now. And if you want to see the divergence, plot Bitcoin's market cap minus Ethereum's market cap. It basically looks like the Bitcoin price chart, because Ethereum is so irrelevant now that it just keeps growing, right? We're over $1.6 trillion in difference. It's just not even the same ballpark. The same is not true for all these other assets. Once you get that flipping over and they're like trying to work out which one's which, I think that's going to be a speculative mania, and that probably is going to look like the top. Ultimately, the flipping will be the top.
Look, it won't be for Bitcoin. Coin market cap. Let's see what the pecking order is right now.
Okay. Somehow Ripple. Oh, actually, I should tell you my Ripple story. So we went to the Bitcoin Bush Bash, which is basically three times a year. I think it's four times now. Here in Australia, we move around different parts of like rural New South Wales, Queensland.
No, we pump the Bitcoin Bush Bash on Rabbit Hole Recap whenever there is one.
Oh, yeah. No, the Bitcoin Bush Bash is great. So anyway, the most recent one was in Parkes, which is like a 5.5 hour drive inland from Sydney. It's in the middle of absolutely nowhere. If you keep driving half an hour, the earth turns red. That's kind of, real desert type material. We're at the pub and we're sitting there just, obviously talking about Bitcoin and whatever. And this guy leans over. He's sitting there having dinner with his girlfriend at the pub. And he goes, "Oh, are you guys into Ripple?" And I was like, "No, mate, we're not into Ripple." And he goes, "Oh, you should. It's going to $8. And his girlfriend's just sitting there like, doesn't know what's going on. I was like, "Mate, if you think Ripple's going to $8, I mean, good luck." Anyway, so we turned away. And I turned back like 10 minutes later and one of our crew is basically sitting there having dinner with him. And the girlfriend's just sitting there just eating her pasta. Doesn't want to talk about bloody coins. And these two were just riffing on Ripple. I was like, I mean, that's a bad sign.
in the middle of the bush talking about Ripple.
In the middle of nowhere. Yep.
What's Ripple at right now? Is that 178 million? Is that what I'm reading?
Billion.
Yeah. Billion. Yeah.
Yep.
Solana's at.
Go figure.
One. Is that 42 or 22? 22. Ethereum 441, if I can read correctly. Hello. 440.
But yeah, there you go. $1.6 trillion difference between Bitcoin and its next competitor. I mean, good luck.
Yeah, the flippening. That was a fun meme while it lasted.
Yes, it was. Well, I mean, I've got this meme that the flippening is coming. It's just not going to be for Bitcoin.
It was funny. Not that I was ever worried, but it was frustrating when it was going on from like 2017 to probably stopped in 2021.
And I think the variable, right, and we're partly seeing that today. The confusion that exists amongst, we've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about this and we've eventually come to the realization that Bitcoin is the one that makes sense. The rest of the world takes a lot longer to do this, right? The average bell curve, right? I think Bitcoin is probably sit on the two left side tails of the bell curve. The whole middle takes time to work out but what about real world assets? It's like, okay, you put a house on the blockchain, house burns down. What's the token worth? But people can't reason about why this. They're like, but it makes so much sense. Like, does it? When you really play through the game theory. So I think the problem with the flippening, and Lynn Alden raised this point way back, I think I talked about in that merge video, is there's this idea that like maybe Ethereum just goes so super centralized and so like we are the bonds and blah, blah, blah. And TradFi completely falls for it. And you actually get this like seeding of their, they see the decentralization component, but they fully give over to TradFi. But ironically enough, Base is doing that on top of Ethereum. So in a way, Base is kind of doing what they probably should have done in order to capture that attention. But Coinbase has just stepped in and be like, oh, cool, new business line. So, you know, it's just tough.
Yeah, it's real tough.
Not unexpected, though. You know, I mean, that's the thing. These things weren't hard to see.
No, people were calling this.
Oh, yeah.
And it is somewhat surreal to watch it play out. I mean, that stat, the candle up 40%. Like that magnitude, I didn't realize we were in that magnitude of a difference.
$160 billion in one day.
Yeah, that's powerful.
It is. And look, and this, it's also, and I used it in one of my reports to kind of explain, like, first of all, recognize how big Bitcoin is. And actually, I was talking about this morning. You know, when you think about Bitcoin at $2 trillion, right? I mean, for most people like us, something like $10 million, that's like a sizable chunk of money. If you look at $1 billion, right, that's 100 times more, or 1,000 millions. If you then look at a trillion, it's 1,000 billions. You've got 1,000 millions. And then Bitcoin is 2 trillion, and yet it's a footnote on the rest of the world. So we're in this amazing concept where it's so big that it moves $160 billion a day. $160 billion is a top 100 company in the world, top 100 asset. It moves that in one day, and yet it's insignificant relative to the size of bonds and derivatives and, you know, everything else.
Well, that's why I was a bit short of words right there, because I was lost in thought, thinking it seems like we're phase shifting away from this perceived competition with Ethereum, Solana, Ripple, whatever it may be, into a sort of awkward pubescent stage where we're bigger than these guys and still working our way up to the big boy markets, bonds, real estate, whatever it may be. And what does that transition look like?
I think that's exactly the right way to think about it. That's why, in many ways, that's why I've been kind of talking about this stuff now, because it is a divergence. It is massive in scale. And I mean, the fact that Bitcoin is still just shy of 60% dominance, and that includes with stablecoins in the mix, right? So if you take stablecoins out, it's like it's 65 odd percent or thereabouts. Just the fact that Bitcoin is still that big relative to everything else is astounding, right? So I think we are seeing this divergence. The kids are going to remain down there and fight amongst themselves and try and work out who's worth less than the other. But I think Bitcoin really has just, it has broken free, not only in terms of its just sheer size and market capitalization, but look how it's trading. Stair step sideways, stair step sideways. We've been trading above 100K for several weeks now. It's amazing that we're just holding here. Again, silver didn't even put up a fight. Whatever silver's market cap is, we just ripped straight through it and that was the end of it. Didn't even try. So you kind of look at this thing, it's like it really is a winner-take-all scenario. The kids can fight downstairs and try and work out which one's bigger, but Bitcoin is just, it's beyond that on a narrative and a market size, which I think is really, really quite incredible.
Yeah. And I think going back to what we were saying earlier, this maturation of the market, particularly credit products around Bitcoin, where you're locking it up, and hopefully many participants in the market are taking responsible amounts of leverage. But I think part of the pubescent stage is just stuffing the collateral in all these different credit products with varying durations from anywhere from 1 to maybe 30 years. If we get residential mortgages with some Bitcoin collateral in them. And then, because I've had an oil gas analyst on the show quite a few times throughout the years, Anas El-Haji, and I've always asked him, like, what's it going to take to get Bitcoin used as a settlement layer for international oil trades? And he's like, liquidity, and it's got to be hundreds of trillions of dollars. It's not going to happen. I think started the conversation when Bitcoin was in the mid to high 100 billions, and we've had it during the trillions. And I feel like I ask him every time, he's like, more liquidity to the market.
Which is just, I mean, that's just your target, right? Bitcoin, yeah. The bigger it gets, I know Jack Mallers has made this point a lot, the bigger Bitcoin gets, the more money you can move through it, the more useful it gets. It's the perfect Veblen good, in the sense that the bigger it gets, the more desirable it is, the more useful it is, therefore it gets bigger. It's, again, the simplicity of the design. Just one final thing on Ethereum. If anyone's ever heard of, I can't remember where I first came across this, but second system syndrome. Mm-hmm. This idea that you have to keep, it's too simple. It can't be. I must iterate. It must be better. I must have more things. And they just eventually realize, nope, they got it right the first time. That was it.
Yeah. Ethereum's the perfect case study in second system syndrome and the application of Gauss law. A system that starts from a point of complexity is never gonna scale or gain a crazy amount of adoption because it's simply too complex. You need to start simple. That's what Bitcoin did.
That's it.
And yeah, for those who are unaware of second system syndrome, go look it up. It's the original case study was some software program that IBM launched in the 80s, I believe, and they decided to scrap it and rebuild it from scratch. And the second system they built never came to market because that's not how systems actually work. Functional systems.
Yep. Keep it nice, simple, and elegant.
Yeah. James, that's what you do here. You keep it nice, simple, elegant, take the emotion out of it. And I really appreciate you coming back on to give an update. Okay. Mention our DMs. I'd like to do this more frequently because I think everybody listening and watching at home gets a lot of value out of this. And I do think as we head into 2025 with all the chaos going on in Bitcoin markets, outside of Bitcoin markets, it's going to be important to get some sober analysis from the man checking the chain.
That's it. Yeah. And that's the thing, right? I mean, just don't try and predict stuff. No one can predict anything. And it's funny because like I still get a lot of people say, but oh, I'm just a DCA hodler. It's like, yeah, but that's the whole point. Like my audience is hodlers. And actually we did a survey because I love to get feedback and find out who people are. And I was expecting there to be like a decent mix of like traders and professional investors and hedge fund managers. There may be, but the survey came back 96.5% self-identify as a hodler. And my thesis was there's a bunch of hodlers out there. They've gone through probably the same journey that I have. They come in, they tried to trade, they lost a bunch of money. They realized, I don't want to trade this shit. I just want to buy and hold. But I want to know why the market does what it does. And that's what I like to do, right? I love analyzing Bitcoin and just understanding why it does what it does. And if you can just frame up why, you can prepare for these things. You don't predict, you just prepare. And if you can just shift that framework to preparing for what might happen, not pretending you're ever going to work out what will happen, puts you in a way better position. If you spend an hour thinking about, hey, what happens if Bitcoin sells off? You just put that in your back pocket. If you need it, you pull it out and you've got your plan. If you haven't, if it doesn't sell off, that's fine. You just worry about it later on, right? You'll use that same framework that next time it might sell off. You're like, oh, I remember I thought about that before. How is this scenario much the same? And that's what I try to help people do. Just think through the scenarios if they happen, not because they're going to happen.
Yeah. Check it out. Check on chain. You can go to charts.checkonchain.com to check out some of the charts and newsletter.checkonchain.com. We will link to both of those in the show notes, and we will catch up with you in a few months, James. Thank you.
Good on you, mate. And yeah, folks, stay frosty out there because we're in a political world and shit's going to be weird.
Shit's going to be weird. Peace and love, freaks. Thank you.